The content of this program is intended for people who are blind impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. But let's start off with something a little different today. This is going to be from readersdigest.com. This is something I was getting on a regular basis, and all of a sudden it stopped. Don't know why. Of course, I don't know why Reader's Digest went from 9 issues to 12 issues to 9 issues either. Anyway, this is kind of interesting. How every state capital got its name. A capital history. When you were in elementary school, your teacher probably gave you a state capitals quiz to test if you knew every capital in the country. Chances are you still remember more than a few of them, as well as knowing many of the state nicknames. For example, most people know that New York is the Empire State and Florida is the Sunshine State. And if you're really up on your state trivia, you might even be able to recognize some of the state flags. But here's one detail for each state in the Union you probably don't know. How each state capital got its name. The history of our state capital's names is as varied as it is storied. Some are named after presidents or notable figures, some are the stuff of legend, and some seem obvious. Hello, Oklahoma City. But many have more to them than that. Many of our state capitals provide us for the best weekend getaways in the country, the best tourist attraction in every state, and even hidden gems. Let's honor their heritage by diving a bit deeper into the stories behind the naming of every state capital. Let's start off with Montgomery, Alabama. Montgomery was named for General Richard Montgomery, a Revolutionary War hero who was killed in battle, even though he never lived in the area. In 1819, the year Alabama became a state, two small settlements merged to form a town named after the general. In 1822, the city became the county seat. Interestingly, Montgomery County was named after a different army major, also named Montgomery. In 1846, Montgomery became the capital of the entire state. Today, Montgomery's governor's mansion is one of the country's most beautiful mansions. Juneau, Alaska. Joseph Juneau discovered gold in Alaska in 1880 with his prospecting partner, Richard Harris. When other prospectors flocked to the area, Harris named the resulting town after himself, Harrisburg. It was briefly named Rockwell, ostensibly because there were too many towns in the U.S. named Harrisburg, but Joe Juneau felt something in the town should be named for him, and in 1881 he garnered enough support to change the name to Juneau. In 1906, the city became the territory capital. Alaska officially became a state, and Juneau the state capital in 1956. Today's Juneau's natural beauty is offset by one of the strangest roadside attractions in America, which I'm not sure what it is because I can't pull that. Well, hang on. So let me see if I can pull that up real quick. Nah, I can't really. I'll have to do that on another time. Anyway, we'll come back to that another time. All right, how about Phoenix, Arizona? The city of Phoenix was built on the ruins of the Pueblo Grande settlement, occupied between 700 and 1400 A.D., until it was destroyed, most likely by drought. In 1867, Jack Swilling of Wickensburg, Arizona, introduced irrigation to the area, then known as Swilling's Mill. Another city pioneer, Daryl Dupa, suggested the name of Phoenix after the mythical bird that rose from the ashes, just as a new city arose from the grounds of an ancient one. The name became official in 1868. Phoenix became the territory capital in 1889, and Arizona became a state in 1912. That's kind of cool for the name of a state. Little Rock, Arkansas. Bernard de la Harpe, a French explorer from New Orleans, noticed an outcropping of rock along the banks of the Arkansas River, the first he had seen since leaving New Orleans, which he called La Petite Rocher, translation, the Little Rock. In 1803, the United States purchased this area, which was then part of Louisiana Territory, from France, although it was still occupied by Native Americans. In 1818, boundary lines defining what is now Arkansas were drawn via treaty that referred to this spot as Little Rock, and the name stuck. The settlement was designated as a territory capital in 1820, and in 1836, Arkansas became a state. Fun fact, Skippy Peanut Butter comes from Little Rock. Sacramento, California. In the first decade of the 19th century, Spanish explorer Gabriel Moraga named the Rio de los Sacramentos, or Sacramento River, after the Spanish word for religious sacrament. The settlement bordered by the Sacramento River later became known as Sacramento as well, and it was designated the state capital in 1854. Today, it is one of the capital cities people always get wrong. Denver, Colorado. In 1858, a group of prospectors crossed the plains of eastern Colorado and found gold at the bases of what is now the Rocky Mountains. The gold rush that followed was relatively small, but a city founded by Kansas man, William H. Larimer, quickly sprung up. Larimer named the town after the most recent governor of the Kansas Territory, James Denver, hoping to curry favor. He didn't know Denver had already resigned. Colorado became a territory in 1861 and a state in 1876. Denver was designated the capital in 1881. You probably already know Denver's quirky nickname, the Mile High City, so-called because of its elevation. How about Hartford, Connecticut? The area around the present-day Hartford had been known by the Native Americans as Sacoayoc. When the Dutch arrived in the 1620s, they called the fort they established at Sacoayoc the House of Hope. In 1635, the English arrived via Massachusetts and created a settlement to the north of the Dutch, which they briefly called Newtown, before changing it to Hartford, possibly because of the founders became nostalgic for his hometown of Hertford, England, or it was usually spelled then, Hartford. It became the sole state capital in 1875, after having been co-capital with New Haven since the colonial period. There's a random astonishing state fact. Hartford is the home to the nation's oldest continuously published newspaper, the Hartford Courant, which began publication in 1764. Dover, Delaware. Like Hartford, Dover was named for a place in England, Dover, famous for its white cliffs. The town was proposed and named in 1683 by William Penn, who also gave his surname to Pennsylvania, if you're wondering how every state got named. He planned to hold a courthouse in the town as well, a big deal in colonial times, which set up Dover as a seat of power. Dover was laid out as a city in 1717 and became the capital of Delaware in 1777, when it was moved from Newcastle farther inland to be better protected. Tallahassee, Florida. Tallahassee is a Native American word for old fields. It got its name from the Apalachee, who had originally inhabited the area since the year 500. It's a hard word to spell, and for that we can thank Octavia Walton, daughter of the territorial secretary of the Florida Territory, so the legend goes. She chose to keep the name for the new territorial capital and proposed its spelling in 1824. The site was chosen as capital because it's halfway between St. Augustine and Pensacola, the two biggest cities at the time. Florida became a state in 1845. Today you'll find Florida's entry for the best hog in every state in Tallahassee. Atlanta, Georgia, also known as Hotlanta. Atlanta was founded in 1837 at the end of the Western Atlantic Railroad line, initially and aptly named Terminus. In 1843, it was named Marthasville in honor of the then-governor's daughter, Martha Lumpkin. At last, in 1845, the city received its final moniker, Atlanta, after the rail line. But Governor Lumpkin claimed that Atlanta was Marcus Lumpkin's middle name and that the city was still named after her. Martha herself admitted Atlanta was her childhood nickname, but thought it simply coincidence that it was so close to the city's new name. After Atlanta was burned during the Civil War, the rebuilt city became the state capital in 1868. Today, Atlanta has the busiest airport in the world. Honolulu, Hawaii. The word Honolulu means protected bay in the Hawaiian language, and it's thought that there has been a settlement in the spot since the 12th century. Despite English colonists wanting to call it Fairhaven, or Brown's Harbor, after Captain William Brown, who landed there in 1778, the Hawaiian name for the city stuck, and it was ultimately declared capital of the Hawaiian kingdom by King Mahalalehele III in 1850, more than 100 years before Hawaii became a state in 1959. Boise, Idaho. Boise, pronounced Boise by locals, not Boise by locals, not Boise, is a French word that means wooded, which legend has it is what 19th-century French-Canadian fur trappers exclaimed when they saw the tree-lined banks of the Boise River. Les bois! It appeared like an oasis after crossing the plains of the eastern part of the state. Some accounts say that they call it La River Boisois, which means the wooded river. Even today, Boise is known as the City of Trees. In 1864, a year after Idaho Territory was established with Lewiston as the capital, that distinction moved to Boise, and the Idaho became a state in 1890. Today, Boise's old Idaho State Penitentiary is one of the spookiest abandoned places. Springfield, Illinois. Famously the home of future President Abraham Lincoln, Springfield was originally named Calhoun in 1823 for U.S. Senator and former Vice President John C. Calhoun, although some sources say it was called Springfield, even though that wasn't its official name. But in 1832, it was officially renamed, supposedly by the nearby Spring Creek, although alternate stories say it was named after the progressive town of Springfield, Massachusetts, or maybe even Springfield, Kentucky. Springfield was actually the third capital of Illinois after Caucasia, which was prone to flooding, and Vandalia. In 1839, legislators included Lincoln's successful campaign to move the capital farther north to centrally located Springfield. Today, Springfield's Abraham Lincoln home is one of the most historic landmarks in the United States. And Indianapolis, Indiana. The root name of Indianapolis, like that of Indiana, likely refers to the Indians, or Native Americans, the indigenous people who populated the land before white settlers. Polis is the Greek word for city. The state of Indiana was admitted to the U.S. in 1816, and the city was built to be the state capital, which it officially became in 1825. Today, the city's Indianapolis Motor Speedway is one of the most popular tourist attractions in the country. Des Moines, Iowa. This capital city is named after the Des Moines River, but no one is really sure how the name of the river originated or whether its origin is French, Native American, or some combination of the two. It's been alternatively suggested that French meanings may be River of the Monks, Des Moines, though monks lived there, or River in the Middle, Des Moines, because it's between the Missouri and the Mississippi rivers. The first mention of the name from a European was by a French fur trader who wrote that the Native Americans told him a tribe called the Moiguina, corrupted in French Des Moines, lived up the river. However, in a recent controversial scholarly paper, one linguist claimed that the Native American meaning of that word is excrement faces. Is it possible that they were playing a little joke on the fur trader? We'll never know. Des Moines became the state capital in 1857. Today, the city is famously has one of the best state fairs. Topeka, Kansas. Some say Topeka is from the Native American word meaning a good place to dig potatoes. Others say it's a made-up word. What's known for certain is the city was founded on December 5, 1854, but no one could agree on a name at the time. Among the rejected options, Webster, after the famous orator Daniel Webster, Midcontinent, because of its geographical location, and Pappin's Ferry, and referred to the local Pappin family, who had originally established a crossing over the Kansas River at the site. We also know that the name Topeka, whatever its origins, ought to be won out. When Kansas became a state in 1861, Topeka was chosen as the capital. Today, Topeka has one of the country's best RV parks. Frankfort, Kentucky. I had forgotten that was the capital. Frankfort has nothing to do with a similar-sounding German city, and everything to do with Stephen Frank, a local settler who was killed during a skirmish with Native Americans in 1780. Because a ford along the river that ran through the area, a buffalo trail that led ways for settlers, Frank's Ford seemed to be a good choice. In 1786, the name was shortened to Frankfort, and it beat out other cities to become the capital when Kentucky became a state in 1792. Today, the charming city is located in the heart of Kentucky's Bourbon Trail, one of these epic road trips for foodies. Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Baton Rouge sounds French because it is. In 1699, French explorer Pierre de Lamont de Iberville described a red stick along the Mississippi River bluff, in French, Le Baton Rouge. The stick was actually a cypress pole erected by two indigenous tribes to mark the boundary line that divided their hunting grounds. The pole was hung with animal parts and thus was red from the blood. Today, a sculpture of the red rocks, the red stick, marks the spot. Baton Rouge was chosen as Louisiana capital in 1849. Augusta, Maine. The area that would eventually become Maine state capital was first explored by the English settlers in 1607, and a trading post was established by people from Plymouth Colony around 1628. They called it Cushnock, a Native American word for head of the tide. Because of its location on the Kennebec River, at the tide head, the point upstream from the ocean where the river is no longer affected by the tide, the trading post was abandoned and not inhabited by colonists again until Fort Western, now the oldest wooden fort in the U.S., was built in 1754. The town was incorporated in 1797 and briefly called Harrington before its name was changed to Augusta, after the daughter of the military general, politician, and Maine's first U.S. Marshal, Henry Dearborn. Maine became a state in 1820, and Augusta was chosen as the capital in 1827. Annapolis, Maryland. Like Indianapolis, Annapolis, of course, is the Greek word for city, polis, and has been called the Athens of America for its wealth of cultural activities. The town was first called Providence when it was settled by Puritans, and Lady Anne Arundel's town, after the wife of Lord Baltimore, Maryland's first proprietary governor, who ran the colony from England. In 1694, Maryland's governor Francis Nicholson moved the capital from St. Mary's City. He laid out new city plans and named it Annapolis, after the future Queen of England, then Princess Anne. Today, Annapolis is one of the best Christmas towns when decked out for the holidays. Boston, Massachusetts. Boston is another capital named after a place in England. Boston in Lincolnshire, where many of its most prominent first settlers came from. Prior to that, though, it was called Tri-Mountain, or Trimont, because of three low hills in the area. Only one remains, Beacon Hill. Boston, England, is thought to be named after St. Botolph, as shortened the time of Botolph's town, or Botolph's stone. A church in that city is still named after the saint. Boston has been the capital of Massachusetts since the town's founding in 1630. Fun fact for dog lovers, the Boston Terrier is Massachusetts' entry for the most popular dog breed in every state. Lansing, Michigan. In the 1830s, two brothers defrauded people in Lansing, New York, into buying land in Michigan that was flooded for most of the year, calling it Biddle City. When the scam victims arrived and found their land underwater, they found a nearby place to settle and called it Lansing in order of their former home in New York, itself named after a politician, John Lansing. Michigan became a state in 1837, and the capital moved to Detroit from Detroit to Lansing in 1847. Today, Lansing is one of the best places to live in the United States. St. Paul, Minnesota. In 1680, the Franciscan missionary and explorer, Louis Hennepin, took note of the land that would become Minnesota's state capital. But no land claims were made there until 1838. The claimant was a tavern owner by the name of Pierre Pigseye Parent, and thus the community became known as Pigseye Landing. But in 1841, a Catholic missionary from France built a log cabin chapel dedicated to the Apostle Paul and renamed the town for St. Paul. In 1849, it became the seat of Minnesota's government, and Minnesota became a state in 1858. Today, St. Paul has one of the country's best zoos. Jackson, Mississippi. First a trading post called Lafleur's Bluff, after the tradesman who established it, Louis Lafleur, the site was chosen as the Mississippi state capital in 1821, 4 years after Mississippi became a state. The city was named for former U.S. President General Andrew Jackson, known at the time as a national hero for defeating the British at the Battle of New Orleans, the last major battle of the War of 1812. Weird but true fact, Mississippi's most famous invention came when a chemist walked through a forest outside Jackson and the idea for pine sol was born. Jefferson City, Missouri. Jefferson City was also chosen specifically as the site for the new state capital. In 1821, just after Missouri became a state, the city was laid out by Daniel Morgan Boone, son of the famous frontiersman, and named for President Thomas Jefferson. There were ups and downs, however, as other towns attempted to move the capital, and in 1837 the Capitol building burned down. But Jefferson City endured and remains today as Missouri's state capital. Helena, Montana. Montana's state capital was originally named Crabtown after one of the four prospectors who found gold on what's now Helena's main street, which they called Last Chance Gulch. As more people moved to town, they decided to rename it as St. Helena after a town in Minnesota where some of them were from. It was eventually shortened to Helena. Reportedly, other names were floated, including Pumpkinville and Squashtown, as their meeting was close to Halloween. Helena became a territory in 1875, became territory capital in 1875, and retained the honor when Montana became a state in 1889. Lincoln, Nebraska. You probably can guess that Lincoln, Nebraska is named for President Abraham Lincoln. But how that happened is where things get interesting. Nebraska became a state in 1867, setting off a fight over where to locate the state's capitol building. Those in the north wanted to remain in Omaha. Those in the south wanted to be in the small village of Lancaster, named after a town in Pennsylvania, to avoid having to cross the Platte River to get to Omaha. The story goes that to discourage pro-Lancaster voters, many of whom supported the South in the Civil War, the name was changed to Lincoln, but the strategy failed, obviously. Carson City, Nevada. Carson City was named for mountain man, scout, and Union soldier Kit Carson, who led the explorer John C. Fremont on 3 expeditions through the Rocky Mountains in the 1840s. Fremont named the nearby river after Carson, and a trading post was established there in 1851 called Eagle Station. When a town was founded at the spot in 1858, it was named Carson City and laid out with a site for a capitol building by forward-looking pioneers. Nevada became a territory in 1861, with Carson City as its capital. The city retained the honor when Nevada was made a state in 1864. One of the oldest cities in Nevada, Carson City also contains one of the oldest cemeteries in the country. Concord, New Hampshire. The community that became Concord was settled in 1726 by a group from Havermills, Massachusetts. In 1733, it was incorporated as Rumford after a town in England. But after a bitter boundary dispute between Massachusetts and New Hampshire over who should have dominion over the area where the town was located, Rumford became Concord, which was intended to reflect the new concordance of the resolution. The city became state capital in 1808. Fun fact, Concord was the home of the Rumford Press, at one time the third largest printer in the nation, and the one that printed Reader's Digest. Trenton, New Jersey. Here's one of the not-so-surprising facts about George Washington. Trenton is the site of Washington's first victory in the Revolutionary War after the general crossed the Delaware River and arrived there for a surprise attack on December 25, 1776. But surprisingly, Trenton was nevertheless named for someone else. William Trent, one of the leading landowners in town in 1719, initially was called Trent Town, which eventually became consolidated in its current form. Trenton became the capital of New Jersey in 1790. Santa Fe, New Mexico. Santa Fe, which means holy faith in Spanish, is the oldest state capital in the U.S. The city, the second oldest in the country, was founded in 1610. It was a Spanish capital, a Mexican capital, the American territorial capital, and finally, the U.S. state capital from 1912. Santa Fe is not exactly the name that was intended by the man who christened it, however. New Mexico's first governor under Spain, Don Pedro de Peralta, wanted it to be known as La Villa de Reyes Santa Fe de San Francisco de Assisi, which means the royal city of the holy faith of St. Francis of Assisi. The much shorter Santa Fe works just fine, though. Today, sunny Santa Fe is a top winter destination. Albany, New York. One of the oldest historic towns in the country, Albany is the longest continually occupied European settlement in the eastern United States. It was originally known in the 17th century as Beverwijk, place of beavers, because of its lucrative beaver fur trade. Beverwijk is Dutch, reflecting that the community was at the time Dutch. That remained true even after the British took control of it in 1664, renaming it Albany in honor of James, Duke of York and Alderney. It would eventually become King James II of England. Albany became New York's capital in 1797. Raleigh, North Carolina. Sound familiar? Raleigh gets his name from the explorer Sir Walter Raleigh, who attempted to establish the first English colony on the shores of the New World in the 1580s. The city was founded in 1792, specifically as North Carolina's state capital, after the prior capital, New Bern, located near the coast, had been damaged during the American Revolution. In addition, the state's population had begun to move west, so a more centrally located site made much more sense. Bismarck, North Dakota. Bismarck is the only capital city named for a German chancellor, in this case Otto von Bismarck. Originally, Bismarck had been named Edmonton in 1872 in honor of Edwin Dell Johnson, a civil engineer who played a crucial role in developing the U.S. railroad system. The renaming, which took place in 1873, had the railroad system in mind as well. That very year, the tracks had reached Edmonton Bismarck, which had received a large influx of German immigrants. The hope was that the name checking the chancellor would inspire German investment in the railroad. All that didn't come to pass. Bismarck thrived anyway, becoming capital of Dakota Territory in 1883 and the new state of Dakota in 1889. Today, Bismarck is home to arguably the best pumpkin patch in North Dakota. Columbus, Ohio, my hometown. Columbus was planned in 1812 as the intended state capital of Ohio, moved from Chillicothe for its more central location and proximity to transportation routes. The new capital took its name from the explorer Christopher Columbus. However, in recent years, the city has chosen to distance itself to some extent from the now controversial explorer by not observing Columbus Day and moving the city's day off to Veterans Day instead. This is a personal editorial. There was a huge statue of Christopher Columbus out in front of the City Hall. I kind of wonder if that's been taken down. I've been back there for years. Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Oklahoma City was founded in a single afternoon on April 22, 1889, during an event called the Land Run, in which the government permitted people to rush in and claim property there for themselves. If this sounds familiar to movie fans, it's because later Oklahoma Land Run in 1893 was depicted in the 1992 film Far and Away. At the time of the 1889 Land Run, the area was known as the Unassigned Lands, and overnight 5,000 people settled there. Townsite companies claimed land as well, and the people organized a city government. It soon became known simply as Oklahoma City. Oklahoma Territory was established in 1890 with Guthrie as its capital. After the territory became a state in 1907, the people voted Oklahoma City as the new state capital in 1910. Salem, Oregon. This lovely spot on the Willamette River was originally called Chimikikiti by the indigenous Kalyupia tribe, meaning meeting or resting place, and was later settled by missionaries in the 1840s. Salem, of course, is also the name of the infamous New England town that hosted the Salem witch trials, in which young women were persecuted as witches in the late 1600s. But it's also the anglicized version of the Hebrew word for peace, shalom. Both factors were likely in play when the town got its name in the 1840s. One of the founders was from New England, and religious missionaries wanted a religious name. Salem became the territory capital in 1851 and remained so as Oregon gained statehood in 1859. Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. In 1719, an Englishman named John Harris became one of the first colonial settlers at the spot that would later become the state capital bearing his name. He operated a ferry crossing the Susquehanna River, so the area was called Harris's Ferry. In 1785, his son, John Harris, Jr., gave 4 acres of land and recommended as a site for a new city to be the county seat, asking that it be named Harrisburg. It was incorporated in 1791 and named the state capital in 1812. Providence, Rhode Island. Providence was founded in 1636 by rebellious religious teacher Roger Williams, who was fleeing Massachusetts, where he had been the victim of religious persecution. When he arrived in his new home, which he purchased from the Narragansett tribe, he called it Providence as a way of thanking God for protecting him on his journey. He established the town as a place of religious and political freedom. The naming of Providence also fits into Rhode Island's motto, Hope. Providence wasn't incorporated as a city until 1831 and didn't become the sole state capital until 1901. Prior to that, the state government rotated between several cities. That must have been interesting. Columbia, South Carolina. Like Columbus, Ohio, Columbia, South Carolina was named for Christopher Columbus. Settled by Europeans in the early 1700s, the site was chosen as the new state capital in 1786, with the name voted on by the Senate, moving the seat of the state government from Charleston on the coast to a more centralized location. Columbia was one of the first planned cities in the United States, second only to Savannah, Georgia. But you probably don't know that Columbia was chartered as a town until 1805, or as a city until 1854. Pierre, South Dakota. The name of South Dakota's capital city boils down to one guy, Pierre Chouteau, Jr., a fur trader who established a trading post along the west side of the Missouri River called Fort Pierre in 1831. A previous trading post had been there since 1817. The area across the river on the east side also began to call Pierre as more settlers arrived during the 19th century. Originally founded in 1880, the centrally located Pierre was chosen as the state capital in 1889 when South Dakota achieved statehood. Nashville, Tennessee. When explorers in 1779 established a settlement at the site of a former trading post, they named it Fort Nashboro in honor of General Francis Nash, an American Revolutionary War hero who had died in the Battle of Germantown, Pennsylvania in 1777. By 1784, the thriving area was renamed Nashville, and it became incorporated as a city and the county seat in 1806. It became Tennessee's permanent capital in 1843. Prior to that, the state government had been moved among several cities. Austin, Texas. The city of Austin was planned in 1839 with the intention of becoming the capital of the Republic of Texas, a sovereign state that existed for 10 years after independence from Mexico in 1836 and before annexation by the U.S. as a state in 1845. The site was chosen along the Colorado River at a small settlement called Waterloo and named after the founder of Texas, Stephen F. Austin, who had recruited settlers to the area. He died in 1836, just after helping Texas become independent. although Texan President Sam Houston later moved the capital away from Austin when Texas became a state, voters chose Austin to resume its role as capital. Located in the Texas Hill Country, Austin and the area outside the city offers endless natural beauty, including the most gorgeous waterfalls in America. Salt Lake City, Utah. Salt Lake City was founded on July 4, 1847, by a group of 148 Mormon pioneers led by Brigham Young, searching for religious freedom. They originally called their new home Great Salt Lake City, after the salty lake near the spot where Young's group had decided to plant crops and create a community. After Utah became a territory, the city became the capital in 1856 and remained so upon statehood in 1896. The name of the lake remained Great Salt Lake, but the city was shortened to Salt Lake City in 1868. Montpelier, Vermont. The capital city of Vermont was named after the city of Montpelier, France, by Colonel Jacob Davis, one of the first non-indigenous settlers to the area, who established the town in 1781. Vermont became a state in 1791, but Montpelier wasn't chosen as its capital until 1805. Its central location was thought to be a neutral ground for the state governor's seat, as it wouldn't favor either those from the east or west side of the Green Mountains. Today, Montpelier is the least populous state capital. That's surprising. I would have thought a bit Montana or someplace. Richmond, Virginia. Another municipality that derived its name from someplace in England, Richmond was named by the town's founder, William Byrd II, in 1737. The story goes that Byrd thought a scenic area near the James River resembled a view of England's Thames River in Richmond Hill, England. Richmond became the state capital during the American Revolution, when it was moved from Williamsburg to a more inland and central location. Richmond was also the capital of the Confederacy during the Civil War. After the war, the city kept its position as state capital. Today, Richmond is one of the best walking towns in America. Olympia, Washington. Olympia's first non-indigenous settlers were pioneers Levi Lathrop Smith and Edmund Sylvester, who claimed the town site in 1848, naming it Smither rather than Smithfield, after themselves. In 1851, after Smith's death, it was renamed Olympia on the suggestion of local resident Colonel Isaac N. Eby, in recognition of the view of the majestic Olympia Mountains, which brought to mind the mythical peak of Mount Olympus in Greece. Olympia was designated the territorial capital in 1853 and the state capital in 1889. Charleston, West Virginia. Not to be confused with the better-known city of Charleston, South Carolina, West Virginia's capital began as a protective fort in 1788 called Fort Lee. It had been built by Colonel George Clendenin and named for Virginia's governor, Henry Lee, the father of Robert E. Lee. The community that had grown around Fort Lee was chartered as a town known as Charlestown, named after Clendenin's father, who had died there in 1790. In 1818, the name was shortened to Charleston. West Virginia split from Virginia to become its own state during the Civil War in 1863. For the next 14 years, the capital moved between Charleston and Wheeling, until Charleston was selected as the permanent capital in 1877. Madison, Wisconsin. In 1829, James Duane Doty, a federal judge, land speculator, and territorial governor, purchased more than 1,000 acres of land in the area known as the Four Lakes region. He envisioned a city put forth as the location for the new territorial capital in 1836 and named it after James Madison, the United States founder and fourth president, who died that same year. Madison retained the capital status when Wisconsin became a state in 1848. Fun fact, Doty also named the streets of Madison after the 38 other signers of the U.S. Constitution. Cheyenne, Wyoming. General Douglas Dodge established Cheyenne as the first Union Pacific Railroad town site in the region in 1867. It was referred to as Cow Creek Crossing for the planned bridge that would cross the local creek. But the name of the town was changed to Cheyenne for the Great Plains indigenous tribe of the same name. Some say the word is from the Lakota language, meaning people, who speak a different language. Cheyenne was selected as the territorial capital in 1869, and it remained the capital when Wyoming became a state in 1890. Today, the historic city offers one of the most romantic hotels you'll find anywhere. And with that, let's switch back over to Consumer Reports. Last week, we were talking about the dangers of dark chocolate, which most of us don't think of as being dangerous because it's chocolate. To determine the risk posed by dark chocolates in Consumer Reports test, we use the maximum allowable dose level per day set by the state of California for lead and cadmium. The chart that I'm going to run over lists the percentage of the MADL supplied in an ounce of each chocolate. Our results indicate the products had comparatively higher levels are not assessments of whether a product exceeds a legal standard. We use those levels because there are no federal limits for the amount of lead and cadmium in most foods can contain. And CR scientists believe that California levels are the most protective available. The chart is divided into four categories. Above the cutoff for both lead and cadmium, 5 bars. Above the cutoff just for lead, 10 bars. Above the cutoff for just cadmium, 8 bars. Below the cutoff for both, 5 bars. While both heavy metals cause serious health risks, products within each category are listed in order of lead level because that heavy metal poses particular concerns and no amount is considered safe. When choosing a chocolate, also consider other foods you might eat that might contain lead or cadmium. Even the safer chocolates, and we found some that were close to the MADL limit, for either lead or cadmium. As a result, eating other foods with these heavy metals could push you over the limit. High in both lead and cadmium, the Thiel Organic Pure Dark Chocolate, 70% cacao. Trader Joe's Dark Chocolate Lover's Chocolate, 85% cacao. Thiel Organic Extra Pure Dark Chocolate, 85% cocoa. Lily's Extremely Dark Chocolate, 85% cocoa. And Green and Black's Organic Dark Chocolate, 70% cacao. High in lead are Tony's Chocolony Dark Chocolate, 70% cocoa. Lily's Extra Dark Chocolate, 70% cocoa. Godiva Signature Dark Chocolate, 70% cocoa. Chocolate, Chocolate Love, Strong Dark Chocolate, 70% cocoa. Lent, Excellent Dark Chocolate, 85% cocoa. I've actually just had some of that. Oops. Endangered Species, Bold and Silky Dark Chocolate, 70% cocoa. Trader Joe's Dark Chocolate, 70% cocoa. WHO, that's H-U, Organic Simple Dark Chocolate, 70% cocoa. Choco Love, Extreme Dark Chocolate, 88% cocoa. Hershey's Special Bark, Mildly Sweet Chocolate. That has got a huge amount of lead, 265% above the mark. High in cadmium are Beyond Good Organic Pure Dark Chocolate, 70% cocoa. Beyond Good Organic Pure Dark Chocolate, 80% cocoa. Equal Exchange Organic Dark Chocolate, 80% cocoa. Lent Excellent Dark Chocolate, 70% cocoa. Schaefer Bergen Extra Dark Chocolate, 82% cocoa. Alter Eco Organic Dark Chocolate Classic Blackout, 85% cocoa. Paschke Organic Very Dark Chocolate, 85% cocoa. And Dove Promises Deeper Dark Chocolate, 70% cocoa. Safer choices. The 5 bars shown here had the lowest level of both lead, cadmium, and our test. Still come close to the daily limits, so we used. So CR experts recommend eating dark chocolate occasionally, not every day. Mast, organic dark chocolate, 80% cocoa. Taza chocolate, organic, deliciously dark chocolate, 70% cocoa. Ghirardelli Intense Dark Chocolate, 87% cocoa. Ghirardelli Intense Dark Chocolate, 72% cocoa. And Valarona Abanayo Dark Chocolate, 85% cocoa. Better ways to eat dark chocolate. Calculating the exact amount of dark chocolate that's risky to eat is complicated. That's because heavy metals can vary, people have different risk levels, and chocolate is just one potential source of heavy metal exposure. But experts say that by being mindful of the risk, you can still enjoy dark chocolate while minimizing the potential harms. Choose dark chocolate with the lowest levels of heavy metal. CR test found 5 chocolates, one for each from Maas, Tasso, Valarado, and 2 from Ghirardelli, with relatively low levels of both lead and cadmium. 8 are more or lower in only lead, and 10 others in just cadmium. Only 5 bars, one each from Green and Black's, Lily's, and Trader Joe's, and 2 from Thiel were higher for both heavy metals. Treat chocolate as a treat. A single ounce of even one of the chocolates with the highest cadmium level and lead levels in CR's test is unlikely to cause any immediate harm. The risk comes with frequent consumption over time. Heavy metals are also in certain other foods, including many that are more nutritious and important to eat, as a regular part of a healthy diet, such as carrots, sweet potatoes, and spinach. So it's best to eat dark chocolate only occasionally. Having a serving a few days a week, especially with a product that has lower levels, means you can eat dark chocolate without worrying unduly, says CR's Tudy Anakene, who oversaw the chocolate test. Try dark chocolates with a lower cacao percentages. If you're considering a bar that CR didn't test, so the heavy metal content is unknown, you may want to opt for a 70% dark chocolate product over an 80% one, for example, or a 65% bar over 70% one. That's not a foolproof measure, but CR's test, as well as testing done by other organizations, suggests that cadmium levels tend to increase with percentage of cacao. Lead levels don't seem to be as closely tied to cacao percentage. Alternate with milk chocolate. Cacao levels are lower in milk chocolate than in dark chocolate, so milk chocolate tends to have lower levels of heavy metals. But that doesn't mean you can eat it with abandon. It has a lot more added sugars, so it is best to eat both kinds of chocolate only occasionally, not every day. Don't assume dark chocolates are safer. Organic dark chocolates are safer. In CR's test, they were just as likely as other products to have concerning levels of heavy metals. Don't give kids much dark chocolate. Dark chocolate isn't a big hit with most kids, which is just as well. Considering the younger you are, the bigger the threat from heavy metals. Pregnant people should limit their consumption as well. Think about your total chocolate consumption. We did not test for heavy metals in cocoa powder, hot cocoa mixings, or other chocolate desserts, but they contain cocoa solids too, so you can contribute to your heavy metal intake. Eat a well-rounded diet. Switching up the foods you eat may help you avoid overconsumption of heavy metals from other sources. Grapes, apples, green tea, and certain other healthy foods can even provide some of the same flavanols that chocolate supplies. Plus, doing this can help provide a variety of nutrients that may help offset some of the harm that heavy metals do. These include calcium, iron, selenium, vitamin C, and zinc. Saving big with coupons, CR's guide. Paper discounts have given way to digital ones and online loyalty programs. Here's how to cut your costs right now. And there's a picture here of a young woman in a grocery store holding a big sign up that says, or a big phone up that says, save $2 for $3.99 for a thing of soap. When it comes to ice cream, I am faithfully unfaithful to any single brand, especially if the price is right. Haagen-Dazs, yes. Ben & Jerry's, for sure. Blue Buddy, bring it on. On the belief that no one should break their diet and the bank at the same time, when guilty pleasures are on special, I indulge. So the moment I spotted the Stop & Shop circular featuring any variety of Breyers ice cream at 2 for $8, it was a done deal. Because the 48-ounce container is usually $5.99, I was staring down a savings of $1.99 each. The deal was further sweetened by a digital coupon that I, as a Stop & Shop Go Rewards member, could download right to my phone. 96 ounces of ice cream for $7. Score! Saving a few dollars here on our groceries may not quicken everyone's pulse. Even I would admit that managing piles of paper, scraps, or spending precious minutes uploading coupons before shopping might strike some as more effort than it's worth. But last year, just before Thanksgiving, my Stop & Shop receipt showed that I'd saved $581.63 so far in 2022, all before even buying one can of cranberry sauce. And that's just at one store, although we shop at several. Not bad for a family of two. If in your efforts to get a deal, you're relying solely on Sunday morning scissors session, you're missing out on an entire universe of deals. Indeed, the tools and techniques to maximize savings have evolved well beyond the circular. Today, you can print coupons at home, download saving apps on your phone, and join store loyalty programs to get access to sales and coupons that exist only in digital, not print form. These discounts, which often must be digitally scanned at checkout, may be more targeted because they are based on your previous purchases and come from retailers and manufacturers alike. Perhaps because of this shift to digital, the number of paper coupons being issued has begun to decline. According to consultant company Kantar, 159 billion paper coupons were distributed in 2021, 12% fewer than the year before. Meanwhile, the number of digital coupons increased by 13%. And yet couponing in all its forms remains a popular pursuit, not to mention a critical tool as consumers need ways to counter the recent inflation. Nearly a third of Americans say they use coupons frequently, and another 45% say they do so occasionally, according to an October 2022 nationally represented CR survey of 2,084 adults. That must be their magic number, 2,084. At the same time, CR survey found that among people who use those coupons, whose use of coupons has recently declined, the top reason is that they now see fewer paper coupons. To some, that raises concern that digital discounts may disadvantage people who don't have access to connected devices, including low-income people and seniors on a fixed income, who may need discounts the most. Consumer advocates, including those at CR, are raising concerns that this digital divide hurts the most vulnerable shoppers. Join the club. When Coca-Cola created what may have been among the first paper coupons, handwritten slips entitled the bearer to a free glass of Coke in 1888, the company probably didn't know that its marketing ingenuity would revolutionize how other companies drive business. For nearly a century after the introduction of S&H green stamps, I remember those, in 1896, they reigned supreme for many people. Though not coupons per se, shoppers could expect to be rewarded with little green stamps for patronizing shops in the S&H network, which they could then affix to collector's books and redeem for premiums from an S&H redemption center or catalog. While the green stamp era has passed, the idea of rewarding consumer loyalty is still going strong, with many grocery chains offering some version of a loyalty program. Customers at Publix stores, for example, can join the Club Publix, launched in 2020, and receive $5 off an in-store purchase of $20 or more. Members also get a peek at the weekly circular a day early and have access to digital coupons via the Publix mobile app. Stop & Shop offers a two-tier loyalty programs in stores. Tier 1 is a Stop & Shop Rewards, which offers weekly discounts online at the register for items featured in the store circular. Tier 2 offers members the opportunity to earn rewards and save on purchases with digital coupons via the Stop & Shop Go Rewards mobile app or website. Per Jensen, Shop & Stop's Director of Loyalty, says that the store can give bigger discounts with digital coupons because there are higher logistics costs when customers redeem paper versions. The downside of digital deals is the contact information and data about your shopping behaviors that you give up for a discount. This may especially matter to you if you're already deluged by marketeers, including scammy ones. There are a couple of workarounds. A representative for Albertsons, one of the nation's largest food and drug retailers, says that people who may not have access to smartphones and mobile coupons or want to avoid oversharing can redress those discounts at the register. Stop & Shop informed CR of a pilot program to install kiosks in select stores where customers will be able to scan their physical rewards card or enter their phone number to access a small printed guide of the best circular offers and digital deals. No smartphone needed. Speaking as someone who has reversed course halfway to the grocery store after realizing I left my phone at home, I am firmly in the digital camp, but my ultimate allegiance is to the deal. If clipping coupons could also help save me money, I say, pass the scissors. The new way to coupon. Couponing is a numbers game, where time spent translates into savings earned. CR consulted with expert deal detectives, to help you make the most of your time in the service of saving. Whether you have 30, 60, or 90 minutes a week to devote to coupons, these tips will help you focus your efforts. Start with the half-hour level suggestions, and if time permits, try incorporating techniques from the hour-long and 90-minute couponing tips. For 30 minutes, join rewards and loyalty programs at your favorite stores. Albertsons, Safeway, and Vaughn share a loyalty program that features $5 welcome savings off a $25 in-store purchase at sign-up. Members earn a point for every dollar spent on groceries, and every 100 points earns a reward. And 10 rewards equals $15 off your entire grocery purchase. Pro tip, you can supercharge those savings while keeping your grocery budget in check by purchasing a store gift card that allows you to earn 2 points for every dollar spent on groceries. Buy a Sunday newspaper to get the coupon inserts. Yes, it could still pay to go old school, so search the inset for coupons for products you regularly use that you would substitute for cheaper or generic options. If you find a coupon for one of your must-have items, consider purchasing a second paper to double down on any buy one, get one deals. Unfortunately, we're not seeing as many of those coupons in newspapers. My last Sunday newspaper had one thing of coupons and only had like 5 pages. Use coupon matchups. Some retailers allow you to do coupon matchups, which allow you to save more by combining store-offered discounts with matching manufactured coupons. For example, if the CVS circular features Bounty paper towels at 2 for $5, a manufacturer's coupon for the same product would be a matchup. To find them, do an online search of a store where you shop and add the word matchup. Deal bloggers such as For the Mamas and the Crazy Coupon Lady create weekly store deal coupon breakdowns. Most will help you find coupons that match to the products. Give yourself coupon reminders. Try whatever methods help you remember to bring coupons when you shop. Use your phone's voice memo option, set calendar alerts for dates when you think go on sale, or just pick sticky notes on your refrigerator. Set a grocery budget and stick with it. Many people can't resist a good deal and load their carts with extraneous items they don't really need. Make sure the lure of a bargain doesn't prompt you to spend more than your budget for your weekly or monthly grocery shopping. Shop from a list so that you can buy only those things on it. The 60-minute option. Watch coupon update videos on YouTube. Searching terms like deals this week or coupon with me will yield videos created by super couponers like Star Smith, who offers weekly 10 to 25-minute store-specific deal updates on how to manufacture them with how to maximize them with manufacturer coupons. National retailers like CVS, Target, and Walgreens are the subject of the largest number of videos, but we also find updates for local and regional retailers. Remember that receipts are currency. Use rebate apps like Fetch Rewards and Ibotta to take in-app pictures of your cash register receipts to earn points that can convert to Visa gift cards. Fetch gives subscribers a minimum of 25 points for every receipt that they upload. Users receive bonus points by buying specific items from a rotating list of manufacturers. For example, Bayer recently offered 1,500 bonus points if you bought at least one bottle of Bayer Cardio 50-count plus low-dose aspirin. For 11,500 points, app users get a $10 Visa prepaid card. A $50 Visa card requires a 52,500-point cash out. Find a Facebook couponing group. Typing couponing group into the social media platform search bubble will have you scrolling through groups with as many as 1.5 million followers. You can narrow your search by utilizing city filter under the group's icon. Shoppers in your area may have tips on local retailers and news about nearby unadvertised spot sales. Subscribe to a coupon provider. Depending on where you live, that may be cheaper than buying a Sunday newspaper. Coupon clipping services, also called coupon fairies, like the Coupon Marketplace, post images of the paper coupons you can buy. A coupon on the site for $2 off on any one of Nature Bounty vitamins is on sale for 20 cents. The cheapest shipping option is USPS First Class Mail for $1, which makes sense when you buy coupons in one or more bottles of 10. Pro tip, the coupon values in the newspaper insights can vary by region if they are offered by the same manufacturer. That 50-cent offer in Pennsylvania may be worth 75 cents in Texas. Coupon fairies in different regions have access to inserts you may not. The Sunday Coupon Inserts website offers a subscription service that will ship whole inserts from companies like Procter & Gamble or SmartSource. The December P&G insert featured $82 worth of coupons and everything from $10 off Olay Regionless Facial Moisturizer to 50 cents off any Pepto-Bismol product. The 90-minute exercise. Join your manufacturer's email list. Procter & Gamble's have 65 brands across 10 product categories and will send you weekly coupons and free offers via its P&G Good Everyday Rewards program that you can print at home. Kimberly Clark, the producer of brands like Kleenex and Huggies, has email sign-up prompts at the website of individual brands like Scott Tissue that will deliver deal offers to your inbox. Beechnut will email coupons set to those who request them. On the site, parents can receive discounts for up to 5 little ones. PepsiCo's Tasty Rewards will mail members up to 10 coupons of their choice. The program offers a print-at-home option and will load digital coupons to retailers Publix and Family Dollar for Frito-Lay and Pepsi products. Contact a manufacturer of your favorite brands and ask for coupons. Many will oblige with high-value coupons, particularly for staples you like or for new products to try. I went to Chobani Yogurt website, navigated to customer care, and clicked the Connect button that produced a contact form with a message field. I wrote that Chobani is one of my favorite brands, but lately I've been buying whatever is on sale. I fished by asking whether they could share any coupons. About a week later, 4 coupons arrived, and 2 of them were for free yogurt. Where the wild deals are. Great ways to save using the apps of some major retailers. Walmart, the nation's largest retailer, will price match itself. Scan an item at the store using the Walmart app, then hit the Walmart.com tab next to at your store tab. If the Walmart.com price is lower, the Walmart store will honor the online price. Target, the Mega Retailers Rewards program gives 1% cash back after every eligible purchase online, in-store or via the Target app to be used for future purchases. Membership also includes 5% off a single purchase on your birthday if you provide that date. Dollar General. This discount chain with nearly 19,000 stores in 47 states offers $5 off a $25 purchase each Saturday that can be redeemed via the DJ app or from the bottom of a printed receipt. McDonald's, the fast food giant app's crunch, grants points for drive-through, counter, in-app, and kiosk orders redeemable for free food. For example, 3,000 points get you a free 6-piece McNuggets. Spending $1 using the mobile order and pay purchase feature scores a free medium fries every Friday. Kohl's. The Kohl's reward program gives 5% cash back on every purchase, which you can eventually use for future purchases when used in store. The app applies to all available store and personal discounts to the item scanned. The store also designates certain weeks Kohl's cash earning periods when shoppers can earn $10 Kohl's cash for every $50 spent. Kohl's cash can't be used to purchase Sephora products. Kohl's shopper ages 60s and older enjoy a 15% discount on in-store purchases on Wednesdays. The same offer applies to members of the military, regardless of age, on Mondays. More insider tips. No coupon policies, whether it's because the store prices are already bottom already, or they offer discount programs, your manufacturer coupons are no good at Aldi's, Costco, Fresh Direct, and Sam's Club. Senior discounts. Fred Meyer, Harris Teeter, Hy-Vee, New Seasons Market, Piggly Wiggly, and Walgreens offer senior discounts of 5 to 10% on many items on certain days of the week. Drive-up discounts. At Albertsons, Giant Eagle, Kroger, Meijer, Publix, and Target, you may not have to step foot in the stores to redeem printed coupons because they will accept them during curbside pickup transactions. Call ahead for details. Dollar D's. Dollar Tree will accept a single manufacturer's coupon per item purchased in-store, including on a buy-one-get-one-free offers. Dollar General issues its own coupons and accepts manufacturer's coupons and allows stacking in certain situations. Coupon doubling. Harris Teeter will double your manufacturer's coupon up to 99 cents. Stop & Shop does the same for its customer who uses its loyalty card. Now, there's one more part about stacking your coupons, but we don't have enough time to do that. I'll pop that in the beginning of next week's program. How about a little humor in uniform to close out? My first assignment as a second lieutenant was at NORAD headquarters. That first day, I encountered scads of high-ranking officers walking around and quickly found myself constantly saluting someone, a general here, a colonel there. It was only later when I learned that the last person in uniform I'd saluted was the mailman. My nephew told his teacher that his mom was on parole. Actually, she's on patrol, serving in the National Guard. Patrol, not parole. And with that, we've just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next week, and thanks so much for listening. I hope my tongue will be working better next week, too. Have a great week.